Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. My guest for this interview is Dr. Tom O'Brien. Dr. O'Brien is considered a Sherlock Holmes for chronic disease and teaches that recognizing and addressing the underlying mechanisms that activate an immune response is the map to the highway towards better health. He holds teaching faculty positions with the Institute for Functional Medicine and the National University of Health Sciences. He has trained and certified tens of thousands of practitioners around the world in advanced understanding of the impact of wheat sensitivity and the development of individual autoimmune diseases. Dr. O'Brien's most recent book, You Can Fix Your Brain, Just 1 Hour a Week to the Best Memory, Productivity and Sleep You've Ever Had, was published through Rodale Books in September 2018 to global accolades. Dr. O'Brien, thank you so much for making the time to talk to me today.
Oh, thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here with you guys and to support this summit. It's such an important topic. So thank you.
Thank you. Before we get into brain fog, the role of diet, food, and how that kind of the impacts on, I think, one of the most frustrating symptoms that people with fatigue can have, I'd love to just start a little bit with your personal story. I was reading in your latest book earlier, I think that actually was your autoimmune fix book. You were talking a bit about your story, and it very much tickled me that you'd actually started off working as a baker and someone who has probably played a bigger role than anyone else around raising awareness around gluten sensitivity. I thought that was very funny. So maybe just say a little bit about how you got into being into this field.
Oh, sure. You bet. Yeah, those days, you know, I was 21, hair down to my waist. Beard, you know, all of that. And it was a whole holistic organic restaurant. And I used to bake, I'd make 48 loaves by hand. And it was an unyeasted bread that rose. It took 24 hours for it to rise. But it was a game changer. It was a destination bread. People would drive from many miles to come buy our bread. You know, and it would come out of the oven and I'd slice off an end cut and it was still hot and I'd put peanut butter on it and then pour honey on it and then slices of banana on top of it. Thought I was being healthy. And it was a blood sugar time bomb. It was the worst thing you could do. We now know one slice of whole wheat bread has more effect on your insulin levels than a Snickers bar. Not exaggerating. It's called the glycemic index. And when you eat bread, you throw your blood sugar way out of balance. So that's where I started anyway. Yeah.
And I know that you had various journeys in terms of your own health that my understanding has brought you closer and closer to then discovering that functional medicine was really an enormous passion and has been for many decades since then.
Yes, yes. My ex and I could not get pregnant 39 years ago. And I was an intern at the time and I called the 7 most famous holistic doctors I'd ever heard of. And I was able to reach them on the phone and asked what they do for infertility. And they say, do you know what a category 1 is? And I'd say, no, learn. Okay, category 1. And I'd write down all these things and I put a program together. We were pregnant in 6 weeks.
Wow.
My neighbors in married housing heard about this and they had been through artificial insemination and nothing had worked. And they asked if I'd work with them. And I said, well, I don't really know what I'm doing on this, but I don't think it'll hurt you. Sure. She was pregnant in 3 months. So we were so excited, and as the pregnancy was developing, we're telling all our friends, and our friends would call their sister in Wisconsin. We lived in Chicago at the time, and she would drive down from Wisconsin to see me. I was seeing patients out of my dorm room illegally. You're not supposed to do that, right? But people wanted to get well, and I was all about. So when I opened my practice, I wanted to help the whole world get pregnant if they wanted the help. And I'll give you an example of what functional medicine is in this context, because it gives you a sense. It doesn't matter what your symptoms are. This is the way you have to think about it. When a man ejaculates and millions of sperm are swimming up the canal, why is it that only one sperm, maybe two, get through and penetrate the egg? When that sperm hits the egg, it secretes an enzyme. The enzyme digests just a little bit of the mucus protecting the egg, and the sperm swims right in, activating a gene that shuts down the mucus so no other sperm can be can get in. Wow. Right? That enzyme in the head of the sperm is completely zinc dependent. So when men have insufficiencies of zinc or actual deficiencies of zinc, they're firing duds. You know, so for guys, the only test that's done for couples with infertility, guys, it's sperm count and sperm motility. And they're always nervous. You know, the tests come back and your sperm count's good, your motility is good. Must be you, honey. And then the woman gets all these injections of hormones when she doesn't have hormone insufficiencies trying to do it. But for some guys, it's a zinc insufficiency. They're firing duds. And there have been a number of couples when I tested the men, and you know, most guys have a zinc insufficiency. Most of us do. Well, 4 out of 5 is the numbers I've seen clinically. 1 out of 5 will not. And zinc insufficiency is so easy to test for. And then you identify and you give them zinc. And then there's over 350 different processes in the body that are zinc dependent. So that's an example of functional medicine.
Yes. Yes.
Is give them zinc if they need the zinc.
Yes.
So that started me off on my entire career from even before we opened our practice. And I was in Dr. Jeffrey Bland, the founder of functional medicine. I was in his first talk in Chicago in 1978. So I've been following Dr. Bland ever since then.
So the key piece we're going to explore in this conversation is brain fog. And I think for people with fatigue, it can be one of the most frustrating symptoms, because feeling tired is obviously miserable, but when your brain isn't functioning and when somebody's trying to have a conversation and you can't remember the end of the sentence that you've started, I know that for patients that is incredibly challenging. And often people will think that the solution to that is in the brain, that there's something that's, and it's not uncommon for people to end up having brain scans and other kind of investigations to understand it. You obviously played a hugely important role in raising awareness around why digestion is so important in this. So maybe just open this up a little bit and say a bit around the blood-brain barrier and the second brain that we really have in our digestive system.
Yeah, you bet. And I'll say that as you were speaking your question, I realized that I'm going to change my language. It's really not brain fog. It's brain fatigue. You know, we talk about chronic fatigue and your muscles get fatigued. It's hard to walk up the stairs. Your brain gets fatigued and it's hard to walk up the stairs of your brain, you know, to access different levels of brain function. So there are numerous mechanisms that will contribute to brain fatigue or brain fog. A very easy one to understand the picture of this is called, and this is a geek word, hypoperfusion. Really good Scrabble word, hypoperfusion. And what it means is a lack of blood flow into your brain. So for people to get an appreciation of what that might be like in my talks, I always ask the audience, could everyone please cross your legs for a minute? Come on, cross your legs. And when you do, and for people at home, please just cross your legs for a moment here, whether you're sitting. If you're driving, don't do it, of course. But okay, you cross your legs. Leave them like that for 3 hours. Stand up and run. You can't, because there's not enough blood in your legs. Hypoperfusion is a lack of blood flow into the brain. When you don't have enough blood flow, your brain is tired. It just can't work right. That's a very common contributor to brain fog, especially when you're feeling pretty good and then your brain's doing good, and a couple hours later, all of a sudden, you can't think straight, right? When that fog comes in, that's hypoperfusion. If there were a pathology in the brain itself, you'd have brain fog all the time, right? But when it comes and goes, that's really a sign that there's something in lifestyle that's triggering what very often, not every time, but very often is hypoperfusion, a lack of blood flow into the brain. And here's a really common one. 73% of people with celiac disease have hypoperfusion. So if you have a sensitivity to wheat, the way that it might manifest is a lack of blood flow into your brain. Now, for every one celiac patient that has gut problems or wheat-sensitive patients, not just celiac, but any wheat-related disorder, for every one person with gut problems, there are 8 that don't have gut problems. They have brain or joints or kidneys or muscles or bones. They get osteoporosis. So the ratio for gut symptoms when you eat something that's not good for you in terms of wheat is 8 to 1. 8 times more other areas of the body. So don't think that you feel fine when you eat wheat, as an example, so it's not a problem. No, I feel fine when I eat wheat. It's not a problem. No. You may be one of the 7 out of 8 when you eat wheat, it causes hypoperfusion. That's all you get is brain fog. That may be the case for you. So it really is about exploration and investigation to find out. With dairy, it's a very similar thing. Just go to Google and type in, there's a type of dairy called caseomorphins, or not dairy, there's a type of protein in dairy called caseomorphins or casein. So just type in caseomorphins, C-A-S-O-M-O-R-P-H-I-N-S, caseomorphins, and sudden infant death syndrome. And you go, what? You want to know what brain fatigue is at its worst? The worst brain fog is when the blood flow stops into your brain. And just look at the studies about caseomorphins or casein and sudden infant death syndrome. If you have a sensitivity to dairy, the way it may manifest is affecting the respiratory centers of your brain. That may be how it manifests. It may manifest as joint pain. You know, it may manifest, you know, I don't do too well with potato chips. I don't, you know, I rarely eat them, but I forget. And so last night I had a nice meal, but there were these homemade potato chips with the restaurant. This morning I woke up, I could barely move my elbow. Right. I went to work out. I mean, I had a hard time putting a shirt on and I had to drive the car and my elbow was just, my gosh, what's wrong with my elbow? I didn't hit it. Oh, all right. So my body's reaction to bad fats is inflammation in the joints. So it affected my elbow, right? Your body's reaction to a sensitivity to dairy or a sensitivity to wheat or a sensitivity to anything else may be hypoperfusion. It may be. You just have to check.
Yes.
So you want to learn what are the things to check for? How do I do that? And that's why I wrote this book. And, you know, it's number 1 in 7 categories on Amazon. And it's like, oh, thank you. Yes. Yes. Right? Because people are reading it and they're going, oh my God, I had no idea. So hypoperfusion is a very common mechanism causing brain fog. You referenced another very important topic, and that doctors really haven't been taught this way. And it's just so accurate though. And that is, we have a barrier around the brain. When you eat food, all the food you eat, there's a protective mechanism in the gut. So if there's some bacteria in the food, bacteria can't get into the bloodstream, right? There's a barrier between the food you eat and getting into your bloodstream. Mrs. Patient, your digestive tract is a tube. It starts at the mouth, goes to the other end. It's about 20, 25 feet long, winds around in the center there. The inside of the tube is lined with cheesecloth. Now, when you eat food, those big molecules of food can't get through the cheesecloth to get into the bloodstream. They've got to be broken down smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until they're small enough to go right through the cheesecloth into the bloodstream, right? That's why your intestines are 20 feet long. One reason is because it takes a whole lot longer to break down prime rib than it does a banana, right? And so you have to have accommodations for that. And eventually, the proteins in prime rib get broken down so small they go right through the cheesecloth. Now, when you get tears in the cheesecloth, that's called leaky gut. And now those bigger molecules get in the bloodstream that shouldn't get into the bloodstream. And the result of that is your immune system, trying to protect you, says, whoa, what's this in the bloodstream? I better fight this. Now you make antibodies to beef or to tomato or to lettuce or to anything that you eat. And it's your immune system trying to protect you. So these are the people that do a 90 food blood test to see what they might be sensitive to. It comes back and says they're sensitive to 25 or 30 different foods. And they say, oh my God, that's everything I eat. Well, of course it is. Your immune system's protecting you. It's supposed to do that. When you heal the gut, then go back in 6 months and test. Now you're sensitive to 2 foods, maybe 3.
And that's one of the challenges that I think people often have when they do those tests, is that they're bemused by the fact that they thought they were the safe foods. They were the foods they were eating without getting too many.
They're healthy foods, right?
But they're the ones that actually come up. They have the problem too, because whatever they eat, as you say, is going to be going through the lining.
Now, there are three linings where there's lots of literature about that operate the exact same way. The lining of the gut, the lining of your lungs, and the lining of your brain. So the lining of the brain is called the blood-brain barrier, and it's the tightest cheesecloth in the body. So even though something may be in the bloodstream, it's good in the bloodstream, that doesn't mean it's okay for it to get into the brain. So the blood-brain barrier is just a cheesecloth. It's just more tight, and so only smaller things can get through. And scientists call it a breach of the blood-brain barrier. I call it B4, capital B, number 4, breach blood-brain barrier. So do you have B4? Because if you've got leaky brain, you've heard of leaky gut, well, people get leaky brain. If you get leaky brain, these molecules get into the brain that shouldn't get in there, and now your immune system in the brain, you know, we have four immune systems in our body, different immune systems, one in the gut, that's the primary one, one in the liver, one in the bloodstream, and one in the brain. And the one in the brains, they are the big kahunas. Those guys in the brain, they're called glial cells. And the one in the gut, the immune system in the gut has six shooters, like cowboy six shooters, right? And they fire those bullets that kill bacteria and all that. The one in the bloodstream is special forces with high-powered rifles, specifically antibodies to go after specific things. But the one in the brain has bazookas. They do not mess around. If anything gets through the blood-brain barrier, they fire their bazooka to destroy it right away. The glial cells are very, very active. Usually they're at rest. They're just standing guard inside the blood-brain barrier. But when they get activated, they destroy whatever is trying to get in there, which is a good thing. The problem is when you've got B4, a breach of the blood-brain barrier, that process is going on continually. Bazooka fire, bazooka fire, bazooka fire, bazooka fire, nonstop. And when that happens, you start to get collateral damage. Brain tissue gets damaged, not just the bacteria or the virus or whatever got in, but now your brain tissue gets damaged. And just as true in every part of your body, when you've got damaged tissue, your immune system has to get rid of those damaged cells to make room for new cells to grow. That's why we exercise and we work out, is that you're actually breaking down muscle fibers. You're damaging muscle fibers. And the result is the immune system comes in to get rid of the old muscle fibers. Then you start making new muscle fibers and you make more muscle, right? Same is true in every part of your body, every cell of your body. That's why it's normal to have a certain level of antibodies to your thyroid on a blood test. There's a normal reference range. When is it ever normal to have antibodies to your own tissue? Well, to get rid of the old and damaged tissue. That's normal. But when you have elevated antibodies to your thyroid, for example, you're killing off more cells than you're making. Now you got a problem. And eventually, if you keep doing that, that thyroid won't be able to function very well anymore. And eventually you start getting some symptoms. And then eventually you get more symptoms. You go to the doctor, they can't figure it out, until eventually you get diagnosed with autoimmune thyroid disease. Or autoimmune myelin disease, that's MS, or autoimmune cerebellar disease, meaning antibodies attacking your cerebellum, and that's a gait ataxia when you can't walk very well as you get older, or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. But all of these mechanisms of the brain, they begin with B4. They all do. By definition, every brain deterioration, including constant or recurring brain fog, seizures, autism, attention deficit, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, by definition, every single one of them is a disease of inflammation in the brain. And where's the inflammation? One more point. Where's the inflammation coming from? That's the million-dollar question. And it's coming from B4, allowing some molecules to get in there, your immune system trying to protect you. I mean, this is extremely sophisticated postdoctoral concepts that I'm giving you in everyday language. But this is the mechanism. This is why we now have a chance of reversing Alzheimer's. Just read Dr. Dale Bredesen's book, The End of Alzheimer's, and it becomes crystal clear. You just have to figure out where is the inflammation coming from and stop throwing the gasoline on the fire causing the inflammation.
And I think what is often staggering for people is that what they eat can have such an impact in terms of their brain and their symptoms and everything else. And particularly that, you know, you mentioned what people often call the big three of gluten, dairy, and sugar, that three of the things which are most common in the modern diet in terms of what people are eating. But maybe say a little bit about why those foods particularly can be problematic. And then it also would be good to come to the actual digestive process and some of the ways that can be going wrong and result in an even worsening of these problems.
Sure. There's absolutely no question. You read the literature, you read the science, there is no question. Every human gets leaky gut every time they eat wheat. Within 5 minutes of the wheat getting through the stomach into the small intestine, here comes the inflammation. Now, Mrs. Patient, you have an entire new body every 7 years. Every cell in your body regenerates. Some cells are very quick, like the inside of your guts every 2 to 3 days. Some cells are very slow, like bone cells and brain cells, but every cell regenerates. So you eat toast for breakfast, you tear the cheesecloth, but it heals. You eat a sandwich for lunch, you tear the cheesecloth, but it heals. So you don't feel anything, you feel fine. You eat pasta for dinner, croutons on your salad, a cookie, a piece of a pie, a pocket, you know, every day, day after week. It's the most common food that people eat is wheat. Just think about how often you eat something with flour. And it's multiple times a day, every day, tearing the gut, but it heals, tearing the gut, but it heals, tearing the gut, but it heals, until one day you don't heal anymore. And that's called loss of oral tolerance. Oral meaning what we eat, and you just can't tolerate it anymore. And that's a very sophisticated concept that when our practitioners understand, really do a deep dive to understand mechanisms in loss of oral tolerance, and that's in the book, The Autoimmune Fix. But when they understand, they say, oh, this just makes perfect sense. Because now the tears in the cheesecloth don't heal. Now you have what's called pathogenic intestinal permeability or the leaky gut. Now these molecules get in. Now the immune system in the bloodstream makes antibodies to fight those molecules. Now, to your question, the antibodies are special forces with high-powered rifles just going after whatever they've been trained to go after. So let's say it's wheat. So they're going after wheat in the bloodstream, and your bloodstream's just a highway. You know, there's lots of traffic on the highway, and there's no lanes of traffic. So everything's bouncing around into each other, but they're all going the same way. It's like driving in New Delhi, you know, where there's 3 lanes of traffic, but there's 5 lanes of cars. And I'm not exaggerating. Oh, nice. It's unbelievable how they drive there. But that's your bloodstream. So now you've got these special forces going after wheat everywhere they can find it. And when they're going after wheat, they're looking for an orange vest. Like when guys go hunting, they wear the camouflage and the orange vest. They're looking for a particular vest. It's a protein signature. I'm giving you a visual in your mind of a vest. And so everywhere in the bloodstream, they're just looking for an orange vest. Boom, they fire their chemical bullet. And boom, they fire their chemical bullet. And the antibodies go everywhere, everywhere in your body, because the blood goes everywhere. So they're just looking for wheat. Here's the kicker. Many different tissues in your body have exactly the same or very close to the same protein signature as the orange vest of wheat. So if you're genetically vulnerable, your soldiers are looking for wheat, but if your genetics are this way, they may attack the myelin in your brain. And you get myelin antibodies elevated, or they may attack your thyroid. It's called molecular mimicry. And what it means is that one tissue mimics the molecular signature of another tissue. And the one that everybody knows about, they really didn't understand why, but this is the mechanism. Why do dentists give you antibiotics when you go to a dentist? There's only one reason. When they're working in your mouth, and they squirt water in, you rinse your mouth out and spit it out in the porcelain tub, you got pink water or red water, that's blood. They just gave you leaky gums. And leaky gums take 2 to 3 days to heal. to seal again, the gum seal on the teeth. The oral cavity, the microbiome of the oral cavity is loaded with bad bacteria. There's hundreds of different families of bacteria in your mouth. But now, because you got leaky gums, if Streptococcus, as an example, gets through leaky gums into the bloodstream and it sets up shop somewhere and it starts colonizing, then you get a strep infection. Now your immune system is making antibodies to fight strep, to protect you. And so now these strep antibodies are going through the bloodstream, and because of molecular mimicry, the strep antibodies may attack the valves of your heart. That's rheumatic fever, and people die from that. And that is the only reason that I know of that dentists give you antibiotics, is just in case some strep gets through your leaky gums. If the antibiotics are in your bloodstream, they'll kill the strep, so that your immune system never gets activated to make the antibodies trying to protect you that may attack the valves of your heart. That's the whole logic behind antibiotics from dentists, is to prevent rheumatic fever. That same mechanism occurs with wheat and with dairy and with tomatoes. It just depends on your genetic vulnerability attacking your brain, or your thyroid, or your liver, or your kidneys, or your eyes, or your joints, or your mouth, or your bones. It just depends on your genetics where the molecular mimicry may originate. So when you read You Can Fix Your Brain, when you read this book, it just all starts to make sense to you, because this is a very sophisticated concept. But when you understand the dynamics of how this thing works, then you know how to explore in more detail, where are my current symptoms coming from, or what am I vulnerable to that I really want headed off at the pass before it kills off so much tissue I now have a disease?
Yes. And for obviously a starting point is getting gluten, dairy, sugar, those sort of things out of the diet. But for many people, particularly those on the fatigue spectrum, that's often not enough to resolve either issues that have already developed, or indeed that, you know, as part of that, there is now multiple food intolerances that have started to kind of take hold. So beyond just removing foods, what are some of the ways to work to correct and heal this?
You have to tell, there is really no shotgun that's going to work for everybody. There are some things that can help in general. Eat more berries is really a great idea, not strawberries so much, but all the others, organic. There's a lot of things you can do that can help. But you really have to know, where do I need to focus my attention? Is it on foods? Is there mold in the house and I'm breathing in mold spores that are causing the inflammation in my brain? We now know that 60 to 65% of all Alzheimer's patients clinically seen are inhalation Alzheimer's. It's what they're breathing that's causing the problem. And it's the gasoline on the fire causing the inflammation in the brain is what they're breathing. Because what you breathe in will cause B4, a breach of the blood-brain barrier. So Mrs. Patient, when you go on vacation for a week or two and you come home, do you like have to open the windows to air the house out? Oh, yes. Oh, gosh, yes. Well, you got mold, most likely. Check your house for mold. Bring in a specialist to identify if you have mold or not. And then they will. And so that may be the trigger.
And how about some of the other ways that one can reduce the kind of toxin burden? So you mentioned mold, but there's also lots of other places in day-to-day life that there can be toxins that can be feeding this problem.
Oh my goodness, yes. It's a world out there. That's why you need a big picture. And that's why the subtitle of the book, Just 1 Hour a Week to the Best Memory, Productivity, and Sleep You've Ever Had. It's not a cutesy title. it's the secret to success, because this is so overwhelming. It's overwhelming for doctors to try to understand this and apply the principles, because they're so busy with what they're doing so far. But it's overwhelming to the patient. So Mrs. Patient, every week, Tuesday night after dinner or Sunday after services, whenever you want, but every week, you're going to allocate 1 hour to learn and apply one more new principle. And in 6 months of doing this, you've got it down. For example, plastic storage containers in the kitchen leach phthalates into your food. You put leftover chicken in a storage plastic container, put in the refrigerator, the next day the chicken's got phthalates. It's not a toxic level of phthalates. There's no study that says it's toxic, but it's accumulative in the body, and you lose oral tolerance to it after a while. So 1 week, and plastic wrap that we wrap around our food, you can't use that stuff anymore because it's poisoning your family. Minor amounts, but accumulatively, it builds up in your system until you cross the threshold. So 1 hour a week. So 1 week, okay, Dr. Brian gave three URLs in the book. All right, I'm going to go look at those. And you go to MilesKimball.com, you go to Amazon, you go to one of the other ones, and you say, oh, those are the glass storage containers. Okay, well, those are okay. Oh, I really like what those look like. Good, okay. I want three round ones and two rectangular ones, one square, one for the pie. And you order them and you pay with your credit card. It took you an hour. You're done for the week. You're done for the week, but that means never again will you poison your family with these minute accumulative levels of phthalates from storing leftover food in those containers.
Because really what you're saying is that it isn't necessarily any one thing. It's correct. Almost like it's like kind of loads on a boat. It's not the one load that causes the boat to sink. It's the too many loads together, which then has that cumulative effect. Well, one of the things that I liked about the book, I very much like that principle of making breaking it down and making it simple. But you also talk about a number of kind of home tests that people can do. Just before we started recording, you were telling me about a fascinating smell test that you'd come across. So maybe yes. Say a little bit about that, because I think there's many more of these in the book that people can come to as they kind of they do their hour a week. But that was a really great example.
It really, thank you. I'm tickled by this because it changes people's lives when they know this. So I'm going to share my screen with you so that you can see a couple of slides here. And we're going to start with this slide here about the importance of the sense of smell. That we don't pay any attention today to smell. Some of us notice that we're losing our sense of smell, but the smell to our ancestors was critical for survival because the nerves of smell go right from the nose directly back to the memory centers of the brain, uninhibited, unobstructed. It's the only nerves I know of that have no obstacles to getting into the brain. There's no screening. They go right back. And the question is, why do they do that? Well, it's for memory recall because our ancestors needed to know about what they were smelling. And this is a cute little quote that about Proust's phenomenon that everyone can read here, that when you smell something, it takes you immediately back to a memory. You know, it might be a perfume and you remember an old girlfriend or an old boyfriend, or, you know, it might be a smell in a house and you remember your grandmother's cooking, but it takes you right back there. So that is critically important when we're looking at memory, that smell is a marker of memory. And the safety, what? Because your ancestors walking down the road or down a trail, they smell lion, they better turn around gently, quickly, and get out of there. So smell was our first and most prevalent alert system. Detecting threats and escaping before confrontations are important for animals to avoid danger and death. Well, that's obvious. Because the area of the brain for smell, called the rhinocephalic regions, are vulnerable to Alzheimer's pathology, get this out of the way there, a candidate marker for this purpose may be odor identification. And I read these studies, and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. This is really interesting stuff. So measuring odor identification, University of Pennsylvania smell identification test, they are the go-to people in the world on this. And I called them to talk to them about this. I said, this sounds really interesting. And it really is. What they told me in 17 studies, longitudinal means over time, they followed people over time, reduced odor identification performance predicts faster cognitive decline in elderly controls and persons with mild impairment. This is pre-Alzheimer's identification that there's a problem there called preclinical Alzheimer's. Now, this one really told the tale. When you have a problem with smell, it's associated. They looked at 1,100 normal people, non-demented, 65 or older. If they had a loss of the sense of smell, there was a 45% mortality rate over 4 years. The other people in the study that did not have a loss of sense of smell was an 18% mortality rate. So it's a marker that your brain's on fire and you got a problem right now. And if you put attention on it, you wouldn't be one of the statistics. So we called the University of Pennsylvania and we came up with this smell identification test. And that's what this is. It's the upset smell identification test. It's so easy. You get a coin and you scratch that little area there, and then it asks you, is this menthol or tomato, menthol, strawberry, or licorice? And then you just circle the right one. Turn the page and do the next one. Scratch it, and it asks if it's cherry, honey, lime, or whiskey. And then you put it where you think the answer is. If you don't know, you guess. We give you the instructions. Just guess if you're not sure. And you do all 12 of them. And then after the 12th one, and you score it, then you turn the page, there's the answers. And so you see how good is your sense of smell. You score 10 or above, you're in good shape. You score 9 or below, you've got hyposmia, a loss of the sense of smell, which is a biomarker saying the memory center of your brain is on fire and those nerves are degenerating. It's a biomarker that says you got a problem and you need to do a deep dive. Now, what's the deep dive? You have to figure out, where's the inflammation coming from? Do I have B4? Do I have food sensitivities? Is my environment toxic? Do I have too much toxic metals in my body? There are many things it could be, but no one knows to check, to start that investigative check that you learn about when you read the book and stuff. No one will do it until they've got a real problem with their brain and they know they have to. But when you do the smell test, the simple smell test, the result is, you know, okay, I got a problem here. I scored 8. That's not good. All right. So I'm going to now learn, where is the inflammation coming from? Then you go back in 6 months, because every cell regenerates, and you test it again. And if you scored 8 the first time, now you're scoring 9. Oh, good. Look, it's not great yet, but it's better. It's 50% better. And in another few months, you score 10, and now you're good. Yeah, as far as you know, the memory centers of your brain have calmed down, and that inflammation that was killing off the nerves has stopped.
I think it's fascinating. And one of the things that I really like about the book is that there's some sophisticated functional tests that can be super helpful, but what you're really focusing on is stuff that people can do at home and stuff that is relatively simple to do to gather information.
Really trying to.
Yeah, no, it's a very helpful way of doing it. And I guess my question then becomes that, let's say someone does this and they score low, like there's an issue amount of inflammation. And as you say, there's many different facets and areas that one could go to. But what would be some of the key pieces of that? Like, in terms of reducing inflammation, yeah, what would be some of the starting points that you'd encourage?
You bet. So the first thing that we recommend to our people when these tests come back low is do the neural zoomer. It's a blood test that looks for antibodies in your brain tissue. And there are many, many different antibodies that may be elevated. And when they're elevated, they're killing off tissue. So we went to the neural zoomer, looks at 18 different markers of brain tissue. The neural zoomer plus looks at 42, I think it is, or 44. So you can identify which tissues are on fire right now. And so that's just a biomarker like the smell test, but it's much more accurate, much more sensitive. The smell test is a general indicator. These blood tests are right on the money every time. You can learn about them in the book or at my website. We've got all kinds of information on it. And once you have that, then you do the functional medicine deep dive. Where is it coming from? Is it food sensitivities? Is there leaky gut allowing these larger molecules to get into the bloodstream? Your immune system trying to protect you is attacking those molecules, but because of molecular mimicry, it's also attacking the cerebellum in your brain. You know, I did 316 consecutive patients. I mean, everyone that came in had this one blood test done, very comprehensive blood test. And it was $535 was my cost, and $535 was the patient's cost. If they didn't want to do the test, I gave them a sheet of paper that had the names of 3 other doctors in the area who are really good, but every patient is doing this test. I'm in the midst of a study, but these docs can help you with your complaints. So every patient between 2 and 90 years old came in. It didn't matter what they came in with. We checked them on this blood test. 68% of everyone who came in had a problem with wheat where the immune system had lost oral tolerance. So they had elevated antibodies to wheat, 68%. If they had elevated antibodies to wheat, 26% of them had elevated antibodies to their cerebellum, that's their brain, attacking their brain, and 22% of those wheat-sensitive people had elevated antibodies to myelin. That's a saran wrap around your nerves. That's MS. That's a mechanism of MS. So one out of five or one out of four people with a wheat sensitivity, and 7 out of 10 had a wheat sensitivity, but if they had the wheat sensitivity, they had elevated antibodies to their brain. That's how common it is. And you just have to find out, you just have to investigate, where is it coming from? So certainly, and I never say everyone should stop eating wheat. I never say that. I say everyone should be tested to see if they've lost oral tolerance. Because once you've, if you haven't lost oral tolerance and you do a comprehensive test, look at the Wheat Zoomer in the book or on my website, that's the comprehensive test in the world. If you haven't lost oral tolerance confirmed by the Wheat Zoomer, then eat wheat, you're fine. But just check it every year or 2 years to make sure you've not crossed that line. But for those people that have crossed the line, you can't eat that. Your immune system's trying to protect you. And because of molecular mimicry, it may be attacking your brain.
In terms of people that have lost oral tolerance, do you see them over time regain that through?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And every single patient that comes back on the follow-up test 6 months later, a year later, and they're clean on the Wheat Zoomer test, every one of them says, well, can I eat wheat now?
First thing I ask, I bet.
Right, that's exactly right. You know, humans are the only species on the planet. We find something that works and we stop doing it.
Yeah. Right?
So my answer is always the same. I say, well, we now know that your antibodies have calmed down and the brain antibodies or thyroid antibodies have calmed down. Way to go. A lot of work. We did great. You and I together, we did great. Way to go. So you want to eat wheat? I don't recommend it. But if you are, go ahead and eat wheat, and in 2 months, we'll do another blood test. If the antibodies come back elevated, now you know. You can't. You can't. And technically and medically, I know no one can eat wheat again once they've lost oral tolerance, even when they get tolerance back, because we have what's called a memory B cell now to wheat. It's why when you get a vaccination for measles, the antibodies are there, but they calm down, but there's now a general, Army, Air Force, Marine Corps general, that's in your bloodstream for the rest of your life to protect you from measles. So if measles ever comes back into the bloodstream, general measles just has to turn on the mechanism to make more antibodies. That's why if you go to Africa, you need vaccinations for yellow fever, dengue fever, all these weird diseases, months and months in advance. But if you go back 15 years later, you just need a booster shot 2 weeks before you go because general yellow fever just needs to wake up and make antibodies again. When you cross the line of oral tolerance with wheat, you make memory B cells to wheat. They're there for the rest of your life. So you go back and eat wheat again, you're going to activate general wheat, and here come the antibodies. But patients want to hope that they can do it, right? And I never recommend it because some people can get really sick when they get exposed to wheat again.
Yeah, I don't recommend it. It seems to be the case that certain foods, particularly being wheat, the body just doesn't seem to do well. There seem to be other food intolerances where people have a reaction, they heal the gut, they calm the system, things start to settle, and they seem to be okay on the other side. But it just seems
Yeah, you're right. There's a whole approach called the elimination diet based on that. Now, the problem with the elimination diet is that it's based on how you feel after you eat the food. Wrong marker to use, because remember, it's an 8-to-1 mechanism. For every one person that has gut symptoms and you feel bad when you eat it, there are 8 people that don't. And so it's the wrong mechanism. You have to check the immune system. You have to check your armed forces, the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, to see, have they been called up again? So they were called up initially. You did the protocols. It all calmed down. The blood tests are normal now. And does it get called up again? So you eat wheat, you eat tomatoes, whatever it should be, and you feel fine when you eat the tomatoes. But if you have the elevated antibodies again and your genetic vulnerability is to myelin, you're going to kill off your nerves again, just like you were before, which is the mechanism eventually leading to MS.
Dr. O'Brien, I wish we had more time, but I'm mindful we're pretty much out of time. But for people that want to find out more, you mentioned your latest book, also your previous book, The Autoimmune Fix, obviously great places. You also have, I think, the best URL in the business. So maybe mention your websites and other places people can go to find out more about you and your work.
Oh, thank you so much. It's thedoctor.com, the DR, don't spell the word doctor out, thedr.com. And we've got lots of videos there. I actually have a brain masterclass that people register for, and it's 37 videos where I talk to you like this on one topic in more detail. I'm so proud of it, and people are blown away by it. They just learn so much in the brain masterclass, and you take it at your own pace. You know, once we give you the password, you get in there, you can do it all in a week, or you can take 2 or 3 months just watching one video and digesting it for a while, applying some of the principles, get the saran wrap out, you know, get the plastic containers out, whatever you like. So thedr.com is where all that information is.
Fantastic. It's been super fascinating. You have a remarkable ability to take complex ideas and make them super simple. A lot of people claim to do that, but you really do that. So thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. It's a real pleasure to be with you.